Welcome to the Cripes Cast. I'm your host, Charlie Behrens. This is the podcast where we talk to people for and or from the Midwest. We are brought to you, ladies and gents, and powered by Everlight Solar. Hey, folks, welcome to the Cripes Cast. Today's guest is comedian Nimesh Patel. He's got several stand-up specials out. He's going to be in Milwaukee this weekend. Funny fella. Glad I got a chance to chit chat with him. Joining me in this intro of the podcast is the fearless Cripescast producer, Colleen Maraca. Colleen, how are you?
You always say fearless, but I have many fears.
I believe it. What's one of your fears?
Hard to narrow. General safety. When I was younger, I was really afraid of like getting caught in a house fire.
Wow. That's interesting. Did you not have windows?
We did. And we also had, my parents got us the ladders to get up, whatever.
So fear should have been done at that point.
No,
right?
Like anytime that there's like tornado watches would freak me out as a kid. Like anything where you have a plan.
Did you have a basement?
Yeah, we did.
Well, that sounds like
everything was in
safe.
Place. Like, okay. Like everything was in place, but like the event of it happening, I just always was like, am I going to sleep through it?
Worry. Yeah. It's the worry.
So that's anxiety.
Anxiety. I think we boil it down pretty quick there. That's nice.
Yeah. I mean, the dark isn't like my favorite place to be.
In the dark?
Yeah. I'm not like, I don't have like great vision. So like in my head, like the thing, like the sweatshirt behind my door.
Could be a criminal, a crook.
Yeah.
Someone there to kidnap you. I see that. Yeah. I see that.
Do you have any fears?
Oh, I would say burning in the firing pits of hell. That's the thing about growing up Catholic is you learn to fear hell at a very young age, you know? And so it still sticks with me, you know?
Yeah.
I don't understand why. I mean, I don't actually logically fear it, but I think somewhere deep down inside, like if I'm feeling like one sort of way or another, I'm like, oh, that's probably like a deep-seated fear of hell, you know?
Interesting.
It's kind of wild. I don't know.
I live alone. And so like, and I live in like an old building. So the tiniest little creak, I'm really anxious. Someone's going to like, I'm on the top floor as well. So I don't know why I'm really anxious about it. And I lock the door like two times, but I have like a little mini brewer bat right by my bed.
Ah, yes. It's good to have the weapon. You know, I find when I'm camping in the woods, it always makes me feel better to have a nice heavy Nalgene next to me just in case I get attacked by a bear. Just something to like put in the bear's mouth, you know, instead of
your arm.
Yeah. Now, granted, if that were to actually happen, I wouldn't stand a chance. I would just be a goner. But I think, you know, a good, healthy fear is it's a survival tool.
Yeah.
And we need it. And we should embrace it.
Yeah.
You know, and then whatever we're afraid of, just sort of like sink into that and say, okay, well, what if, you know, because a lot of times the fear is the worst part, you know, the anxiety of things that never happen. We're always concerned about clouds not in the sky, you know. Right?
What?
Like, what's the weather going to be like tomorrow, you know?
Oh.
Yeah, it's a sunny day right now. Why are we concerned about tomorrow, you know?
That's profound
as hell. The Bible says, let tomorrow take care of itself.
That's like one of my favorite verses. Do you know which one it is?
Don't worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will take care of itself. Matthew 18:96. Who knows?
6:34.
Somewhere
super close.
In there.
You had Matthew right.
Yeah,
good
I
job.
Had a feeling. It's somewhere deep in the brain. Like
Look
I said,
at you.
Hey.
I'm so proud of you.
If you got a deep sea of fear, hell, you got some Bible passage tucked in somewhere
for sure.
Up there.
Yeah, I've been seeing a lot of TikToks recently, and I think it's because my camping group will send them to each other, but people, going back to bears, people just really are pretty casual with bears coming up to their windows and giving them berries.
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't do that. Yeah, you're not supposed to feed the bears. That's not good. See, that's why bears get curious, you know?
There's one bear, I think, called Big Hoss that eats other bears. And
how do you know he eats other bears?
Because he's tracked. There's a lot of stories about him because he's like gone so rabid that
he's a rabid bear.
Yeah, hold
imagine
on.
The rabid raccoon that bit that bear in the ass.
You
what
think?
A ballsy ass.
I don't
ass.
Know if it's like actually rabid, but hold on. It's like they essentially got a taste of something, and now they're like, hold on, let me find this story. It's in our World's biggest, sorry, it's not the Hoss, it's the Boss.
The Boss.
World's toughest bear, the Boss, survived being hit by a train and fathered 70% of his cubs in his region.
Fathered 70% of the cubs in his region?
Survived getting hit by a train is another part of that.
Oh, I'd see, that blew right past me. Where did the train hit him?
The Boss, an extraordinary 600-pound bear in Banff National Park, Canada, where I was this summer, survived a train collision and dominating as the largest and oldest resident. Nicknamed for good reason, the Boss fathered an impressive 70% of the area's cubs, establishing his reign atop the local food chain. The behemoth has even cannibalized other grizzly bears, showcasing unparalleled resilience in the wild. Despite a run-in with the train, the Boss remains an awe-inspiring force in Banff National Park, embodying the epitome of bear toughness. I responded back in this. I go, why is this article like glorifying this bear?
Well, I mean, that is a badass bear. I mean, he's really getting himself out there. Like, yeah, toughest bear, fathered 70% of the cubs in the region and got hit by a train. He probably saw the train. He's like, that train's not going to hit me. I'm going to hit that. Mm-hmm. There's probably a little bear train running around right now.
Yeah, I don't know.
On its way to Shining Time Station.
Yeah.
That's wild. Well, good for that. Good for Boss.
Yeah.
Good for the big Boss, man. That's cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's enough bear talk, I think, for one intro.
Very good.
Very good. Exactly. My guest today, Nimesh Patel, he is going to be at Turner Ballroom in Milwaukee this Sunday. Mm-hmm. And then Saturday, next week's guest, Masood Boomgaard, is going to be
at the Pabst. So he's next week's guest on the podcast, but he has a show this weekend. 2/24.
Mm-hmm.
Just to clarify that.
There we got it.
It was kind of confusing to me.
But anyway, both very talented comedians. Yeah. You guys go check them out. And before we dive into this week's episode, as we have for the past several weeks, we are continuing to raise money for Doctors Without Borders. Several months we've been doing this. We've been raising money for Doctors Without Borders. They are putting money where it needs to go in Gaza. They have some very brave folks doing as much as they can in a very difficult situation, which just continues somehow to get worse, which is, I think, very frustrating for everybody to see. And a way that you can be a little bit of help, donate to Doctors Without Borders, follow them, all that sort of stuff. So there you have it. All right. And folks, without further ado, here is my conversation with Nimesh Patel. How are you?
Getting up.
Sorry, is it an early one? Are you on the East Coast right now?
It's 10, yeah, but no, I'm fine.
I think we did you do Just for Laughs, the Kevin Hart thing, the pitch panel? Mm-hmm. I think I was on that same pitch panel.
Did you pitch to Kevin and then not get anything?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. the famous one.
Was that the one where he said, I'm going to pick them all up and then none of them? Yeah.
That was fun.
That was classic. So you're coming to Wisconsin then?
I'm coming to Milwaukee on Sunday, yeah.
Nice. Have you been to Milwaukee a bunch before?
I only did it I think like a year and a half ago, but only at improv on a Sunday, I think.
Okay, got you. Yeah. Awesome. How's the road been? You burnt out? You feeling good?
It's been all right. Yeah, I'm pretty much done touring though, for sure.
Yeah,
I should be done at the end of June. But yeah, burnout is a real thing for sure.
Yeah. How long has this stretch been for you since you started it?
It's going on. I feel like I've been touring for 3 years straight now. But this tour has been since September.
Yeah.
But before that, my tour ended in like April or May or something, but I started, I hit the road again in like July just to like get material going. And then the theater started in September, but I'm going back to clubs at the end of this month, and I won't be doing anything but clubs until May. So I'm looking forward to that, just to like sit in the city for a while. This is my last theater for a bit.
Yeah. Nice. Do you find like when you're on the road so much, it's just hard to kind of like be a real person, kind of like get maybe sort of real interactions with like people, or just act like a normal person in order to create material?
Yeah, I mean, my theaters are usually like one in, one out. Like I'll be in and out of the city. So it's like impossible to really like actually do anything, see the city. I usually get into a city like a few hours before the show, and then I got to go into pre-show routine of like writing and working out and napping and all that. And so it becomes impossible, almost impossible to see anything or eat anywhere that's like acclaimed or anything like that. And then after the show, I'm like, I don't want to do anything. I just want to go home. Back to the hotel and like sit around. So
yeah. Oh, you get a nap in before the show. I feel like that would fuck me up a little bit, but that works. You got a
nap
in the
gym, wakes you up.
Nap, gym, got it.
Shower, good to go.
Do you do any meditation or anything? I've been doing these meditations before I go on, and like this breathing exercise thing.
I would love to. I think it would be fun to add to the or important to add to the pre-show routine, but I don't have the practice of it. You know, I try to do my daily stuff of like morning reading, morning dancing, morning walking, all that kind of stuff. Meditation has not made its way in, but I think Kevin Durant had like a thing where he said like, I don't meditate, but you know, when I read, I'm meditating effectively. When I'm listening to music, I'm meditating. When I'm playing basketball, I'm meditating. So as I know, that's not actual meditation, but that's about as much focus as I can give to something without feeling like I gotta do something else. And like reading is probably the closest I get.
Yeah. What are you, where are you reading right now?
Right now I just started 10 Equations That Rule the World, by this math professor. Just because I'm not good at math, and it's important to flex your brain with skills that you are not good at. So I'll just take my time trying to read through this book about right now. It's the chapter one is called like the judgment equation, how you should look at judging events in your life. And really you should be a lot more optimistic and positive about things, because the outcomes of negative things are pretty low, and you could put it all in kind of a math equation. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Like he starts with the example of like, if a plane is shaking, what are the odds that it's going to crash? And, you know, if given that it's shaking, it goes through some long probability equation. I'm like, oh, okay. If I try to remember this, maybe I will apply it to lots of my life. It's called I think it's a Baynes equation, something like that. I got to reread it. But yeah, that's what I'm reading right now.
That's interesting. Yeah, because we spend so much of our time worrying about stuff that never happens is basically what that is.
Yeah, well, like, you know, what are the other example he gives is like, what if I start a new job or start a new class and some lady, and I'm trying to make friends, and I overhear some lady talking shit about me. What are the odds that she hates my guts versus the odds that she's just like having a bad day and just said something and I could repair it tomorrow kind of thing? Like, yeah. It's just an optimistic way of looking at the world. So appreciate it.
Yeah. I like that. Do you read a lot of when you're reading, do you read a lot of books like that sort of, would that be in the self-help kind of category, or what would that be? What category would that be in?
I'm all over the place. When I read, I'm not really, I'm just like, if something book cover catches my eye, I'm like, okay, this seems cool. Like I was at the airport and I picked up for the first time a Cormac McCarthy book, and I was like, three pages in, I'm like, what? This is not English.
So, which one was it?
The newest one, something Blood. I forget what it's called, but I haven't picked it up in a few weeks, months, okay. Actually, because it's just like, I'm on page like 17. I'm like, well, I don't know what the fuck is going on. It's not one of these books you could pick up and put down. And what was the other one I just finished? I just reread Blink.
Oh, yeah. It's a good one.
Malcolm Gladwell. which is pretty easy. I guess the last few have been kind of on the spectrum of self-help for sure, but more like reading about emotional intelligence and then reading about how to think in difficult situations, more business oriented books rather than just self-help in particular.
Yeah. Do you read those? Like, is it kind of like a relaxing thing, or is there like some underlying, like, do you try working those sort of things into material or how people think, or just like for the fun of it?
It's usually just for my own edification, just to get a better understanding of myself, as opposed to and probably apply the lessons that I read in the books to my day to day. It's really hard to, once you take something from a book and try to explain it on stage, it becomes your teacher, and that's not really what I want to do comedy wise. Yeah. Unless I like, maybe it's like one term or something that I take from it. I'm like, oh, I could insert this into some bit, but 99.99% of the time, it's like, it's just for myself. It ends up being for myself.
Yeah. Do you think it's hard, like, being someone who has to like put out a lot of content to sell tickets and all that sort of stuff? Do you think it's hard, or do you find it hard to give yourself time to like absorb other art, like watch shows or read books or
do that? 100%. You know, a lot of for better or for worse, a lot of my quote unquote success has been kind of self-made, and so that being from like the top down of like actually just getting stand-up written and done to distributing it and chopping it up and all that kind of stuff, like it consumes all of your time. And so it's harder to find time to do other stuff for sure. And so a lot of it gets delegated, but that comes at a cost and all that kind of stuff. And then you're effectively running a business. So it becomes, that consumes your brain, my brain rather. And it becomes difficult to then focus on other stuff, just like living life and absorbing culture. But like I said, as the tour kind of, as this tour winds down, I must say it's not even close to winding down yet. It's still 4 months, but as I look ahead, the focus will resume being like being a person as opposed to being a business, so to speak, you know?
Yeah. Like how do you, do that and like make that conscious choice, you know, or is it a conscious choice, or is it like, no, I'm going to exist? Plus at this point, you obviously get recognized when you go around as well. So there's that on top of everything else.
It's a conscious choice for sure. To be a human being now, like I know I have to go out and do stuff. Cause like, you know, to write comedy, you have to have experienced life. There's only so much introspection you could do before it's like, all right, I'm at a like a personality block, writer's block, personality block kind of thing. You know, I'm not going to be able to, I'm not going to have a new perspective on this for a while. So I got to go do something else. And then hopefully in that other thing, get some perspective on that. And then come back to this thing that's been percolating my brain, you know?
Yeah.
What was the second part of your question? Sorry.
Just like if it's hard, you know, you're a known figure, obviously. So if it's hard, like just being out and about and people recognizing that changing your.
No. New York is, I'm a small fish in a massive pond. Man, so like no one gives a fuck here.
Yeah.
People will say, hey, and once in a while, but that doesn't bother me. I enjoy it for sure.
Yeah.
It depends on if I'm like out, because if I'm out, then I'm probably not sober. And then it becomes, I'm either drunk or high. And when I'm high, I'm just like, I can't be engaged in this conversation for more than 2 minutes before I get the fuck out of here. Cause I don't know you. If I'm drunk, I'm like, I might say some shit that, didn't come out right. So I gotta get the fuck away from you too. But I'm pretty good at trust myself to have like normal candid conversations. If I'm too fucked up, then I make it known that I'm too fucked up to talk to somebody.
Yeah, I got you. So how did you get your start in comedy? I know I've heard you tell the story before, but just for this audience.
I started in 09, August. It was a year after I graduated from NYU with a degree in finance. And so I was like underemployed, unemployed, while all my peers were making things of themselves. And I think had it not been the right time intersection of like not being a fertile market for less than stellar students and me reckoning with if I actually wanted to do the whole finance thing at the same time, I don't think I would have started stand up. But it was like, even if I really wanted to do finance at the time, like there was not a lot of opportunity for me to pursue it in the way that I thought I could pursue it or should have been pursuing it the way my friends were, like in investment banking and hedge fund jobs. I could have been like I could have just joined some company as like a financial analyst and I've been on a path to, you know, be middle management or something at some point. But my ambitions were bigger. And fortunately and unfortunately, there were not a lot of opportunities for a student with my caliber with no connections. You know, I was like a 3.4, 3.5 student when my peers were like 3.7, 3.8 going to, and that's like a huge difference in the banking world, you know. That plus really being like, I just did finance at school because it was something everyone else was doing. Like I'm here, I am like pretending to know anything about finance, you know? And so when I was underemployed and unemployed that summer, I was like, I gotta do something, with myself. And I took a writing class. That shit was corny. And then I just went to spend like a few weeks trying to write a stand-up routine and then put something together like in 2 nights and went out stage at Stress Factory in New Brunswick and all my cousins were there and that was it. That was caught the bug and I've looked back plenty. I never looked back. It was full speed ahead and I was just like, oh, this is something to do and something I know how to pursue at least at this level, which is just get on stage and write jokes, rinse, repeat.
So, like at that time too, it's sort of the height of the recession. Did that like impact your ability to kind of get a job and sort of drive you more toward like a unconventional path, or was that not as big of an influence?
I'm sure. Yeah. I'm sure that played a massive role, you know, applying and then not getting any jobs. Also, it had like a real summer internship, you know, with a lot of these places like investment banks, you got it. Work there your junior year. You got to work a summer internship as a bank over the summer. That's like your start to your way in. I never had that. And so I think the few investment banking interviews that I did get, I think it was pretty transparent that I didn't really have a full interest in the gig.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, everyone could talk the talk. And walk the walk. I could barely talk the talk and I had not walked the walk. So the two places I ended up getting super days at, one of them, I think I flubbed the interview on the third day. And then the other one, it just didn't work out. I forget why. But it was something like, oh, they just chose someone who was younger or something like that, but like 6 months or something. I forget the exact reason, but it was something heartbreaking, but you know, in hindsight, didn't matter. At Houlihan Lokey, that's where it was. I remember that much. Investment bank.
Yeah. So blessing in disguise on that. But then you start off doing stand-up. You got the one show, you've got, you know, your family in the audience. Did you have like an unrealistic expectation of what every audience would be like after that? Or was it just, I mean, were you just doing well at the shows at the beginning?
No, by no means. You know, the first one was an open mic bringer. But there was like a full show because it was in New Jersey and it was a Wednesday and like everyone had to bring a bunch of people. That Thursday, Friday after that, I did Eastville, which was in East Village at the time, It's now in Brooklyn, but it was East Village at the time. And that was like, oh, it's going to be just like the other one that I walk in. I was like, there's six comedians here. And that's it. It's 5 o'clock on a Friday. And I bombed with some of the same material that did well on Wednesday. And so that was quickly shaken of any illusions of stand-up comedy being fun and easy all the time. It was very much so, oh, okay, this is probably closer to what it is. The six people sad Friday open mic, as opposed to a packed show full of people there to support their friends.
Were you kind of second guessing it at that point, or were you just like still full bore ahead with stand up?
I mean, my thoughts never second guessed it. I thought I could do stand up and have a real job. And so I was still looking for real work. But it was just like, I got to find a job in New York City as opposed to like New Jersey or Connecticut or something so that I could actually still do stand up. At night, do open mics and all that. And so there was no, it was like, I was maybe dreaming in that sense that I would be able to do both wholeheartedly. And it became apparent probably in my first real job that was not going to be the case. I worked at a hedge fund as a research assistant, and I was on a path to be an analyst had I like been good or focused or whatever. But, you know, I would leave at like 5 or 6 o'clock every day to go do open mics. And so that job only lasted like 8 months, cause my work definitely suffered and I was very apparently not really into the gig itself. And then my next job, I told them I was doing stand up. And so I joined as like an assistant to a bunch of, I think I was 24, and I joined as an assistant to a bunch of like 22 year olds who were going to make like more money than my parents, you know? it was a humbling experience, but I told them, I was like, this is what I need to do so I can pursue this kind of thing and see it out. And they were cool with that. And so that is how I kept my kind of bills paid and all that, while I did stand up, and I just kept at it.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are powered and presented by Everlight Solar. This studio, it's literally lit the heck up by Everlight Solar, ladies and gents. The solar panels on the roof are doing the action. Spring is coming, and the sun, oh, that sun's coming too.
It's peeking out.
It's peeking out, and it's powering those panels, and those panels are powering this. Thanks to Everlight
powering
Solar.
Powering this podcast. So many P's.
So many P's. Call Everlight Solar. Go to everlightsolar.com, whatever you got to do. Book your free consultation to see how solar power and solar energy can work for you. And Fleet Farm, folks, did you know your dog's favorite store is the Fleet Farm? That's right. Nothing makes the tail wag harder than when your dog sees you walk in the door with that Fleet Farm bag full of their favorite goodies. You can get everything your dog loves, like toys and treats, or find quality, healthy food from an endless selection of top brands. Or maybe you're a cat owner and you're looking for the perfect
roll your R.
No, I don't want to. Fleet Farm has an amazing selection for all that as well. Pick up everyday favorites from your four-legged friends over at the Fleet Farm. And finally, folks, let me tell you what. If you're looking for some Manitowoc Minute merch, some Midwest merch, go to CripesCast.com, click on the merch section. Great way to support the Cripes Cast. We've got all the stuff you need there, despite the fact that Colleen was at a yawn. Jeez Louise. We got cards, koozies, shirts, roll out the barrel coming up with the Brewers season, everything.
Go Cubs.
And also, no go Cubs, Colleen. And if you are heading over to CripesCast.com, click on Patreon.com/CharlieBarons. Click on the link there. You can get extended intros, deleted scenes, early notice on show dates, and a whole heck of a lot more. Check it out. Patreon.com/CharlieBarons. All right. Let's get back to the CripesCast. Did you like grow up thinking that like, hey, I'm a little bit funny, maybe I'll get into this? Or did you just kind of fall into it?
I fell into it for sure. I thought I was funny, but I look back at my funniness and think I was more mean than I was funny, I think, reactionary, sarcastic than I was actively funny guy.
You know, yeah.
Yeah, totally. Uh-huh. Like a lot of people, I think when they're first trying to make jokes, or if I were to like meet someone after a show or something, sometimes their jokes are often just like roasting somebody else or being a jackass about something. Cause that's kind of a,
right.
It's sort of a reactionary instinct.
Exactly. So I was more that, than like actively, you know, like walking into a room and kind of just starting off in the middle of a story kind of thing. And so when I started stand up, it became, okay, now I'm going to be an active person, make observations about the world and really kind of go out there. But yeah, like, again, like I don't know exactly what the leap was from taking a writing class that was fine, but like sappy for more, for lack of a better term, to doing stand up necessarily. I think I was just like, I thought I was funny. I could write, I wanted to write. And I was like, okay, what combines those two things? And I had no idea like how to write a show or anything. You know, I took like a screenwriting class, not a screenwriting class. I bought a screenwriting book at Barnes & Noble. I would go to Barnes & Noble and try to write a movie, but that was like to no end. And I just, I forget exactly when it hit me. I was like, hey, man, let's just try stand up out. Maybe I might have caught like a Chris Rock special or something that like rejiggered my brain to be like, oh, yeah, stand up. And then went on stage.
Yeah. So you're doing this then. You're pushing through. You've got the part-time gig. When do you take it from sort of a part-time thing to a full-time thing?
Well, I got my first writing job in 2016 with Rock, because I had a finance job until then, and that job kind of coincidentally ended at the same time that my first writing job with the Oscars in 2016, those Oscars So White, those Oscars, the finance job ended at the same time that that job started. And so it was like,
it made, you know, sense from there. Kind
of aligned in that sense. And then I thought I'd go back into the world of finance or, you know, corporate while still having a, while still just like doing stand up at night. But that didn't pan out. Apparently it was like a very, I couldn't go back to, I had progressed enough in my finance job that I was an associate, like looking at investment opportunities. Just low level stuff, nothing crazy, but like for a family office being, you know, running some billionaire's money, a small portion of it. And after the Oscars, I was like, can I go back? And like, there's no way I could be a full, I had a dream gig of like looking at investment opportunities, making, you know, an okay amount of money and still being able to do stand up. There's no way I was going to be able to go back into that world and maintain the same kind of work-life balance. And so I was like, okay, do I go back to being an assistant? But then, you know, I wasn't going to make as much money. And I was, I don't forget how old I was at the time. It was like 30. I was a 30-year-old, 6 foot tall Indian guy that just wanted to be an assistant. Like that didn't make a lot of sense to a lot of people. You know, I present as a banker or present as like, okay, I'm going to be really chomping at the bit to do more than I say I want to do. Again, like I try to go become like a copywriter with the Oscars on my resume, but that doesn't mean anything to anybody. And so like for like 6 months, I put it around trying to find a job, collect unemployment, all that. And then I think I got a job with Awkwafina in like September, like on her, one of her TV shows. Her show talk with Awkwafina on Go 90. And yeah, that was like the sign. I was like, okay, I guess I'll just hopefully, you know, hopefully stand up works out. Hopefully this comedy thing works out.
Yeah. Go 90, man. That's a
long time ago.
Yeah, seriously. The Chris Rock thing, how did that come about? Cause you were going from working and you were doing stand up, but
I used to run a show. My own show in New York, with two of my friends, Michael Che and Mike Denny. And, it became a very popular show. and like an independent bar show. And Chris was coming to see somebody, Langston Kerman, and Chris was late. I got wind he was coming. I was like, I got to go up and perform in front of the reason I started comedy, basically. And I went up. I did well. That was it. saw me. So you're funny. And then he kept me in his brain and then gave him my first shot.
That's awesome. I mean, it, I guess it goes to show, like, there's a lot of comics that, I guess, listen to this podcast, but, a lot of people will message in asking for advice and whatnot. And I mean, it seems like what you did was you started your own thing the whole way, even to the point of just starting your own stand-up show. How important is that kind of thing for, like, comics coming up?
I think, now, as in always, you are in control. You can only control what you can control. I think I spent a lot of time early on trying to figure out why I wasn't getting X or Y or Z, you know, like, you know, why didn't Comedy Central put me on their showcase or why didn't JFL make me a new face kind of thing. And it was like, okay, I can't really control. All I can do is control this act and how I put myself out there. And I consider myself late to the game of putting myself out there on my own. You know, it was only after when pandemic hit and Schultz has started to prove himself out as on like the internet. Granted, he had a lot of other things and it's working in his favor in terms of all this other act like Geico and all that kind of stuff. But what really did it for him was putting himself out there on the internet. And I kind of was like, I hesitated for a long time to do that from a fear of burning material position. Once I had nothing else to do, you know, pandemic kind of put that in perspective. Like I have literally nothing else to do. I got to put myself out there. I can't do stand up. I'm not making money doing anything else. Let me put this stuff on the internet. And started controlling only the things I could control. Things kind of lined up here and there. I think you got to, like anything, you got to make your own opportunities. And there's never, I don't think there's ever a problem, for lack of a better term, doing that. I think you, when you make your own opportunities, good things tend to happen as long as you follow through on your making of opportunities. You know, we had that show that Chris Rock saw me at for, I would say, since 2011 or 2012. And we did it every Monday, rain or shine, 6 people or 70 people. It was a room for that held maybe like 30 people. It grew to, like, you know, being a fire hazard every Monday because Che got famous pretty quickly. But no matter what, we just kept at it. We were just consistent with it. And I bombed a lot there for sure, but just kept at it. And then at the very least, I just got better at bombing, you know?
Yeah.
And the best part, you know, in addition to all the fun parties that we had there every Monday night and the friends we've made and the memories we've kind of kept forever, you know, people got opportunities from that opportunity that we created for ourselves. You know, the writing job for me, you know, tons of other shows, stand-up shows that other people got to be on because they came to the show and did the show kind of thing. So yeah, short answer, yes, it's very important to make your own opportunities. It's the only thing you can control. As long as you do them wholeheartedly, you know.
And that's
be like, oh, I did this and then this didn't happen. What the fuck is going on? It's just like, yeah, it's not going to happen constantly. It's 99% of the time, nothing's going to happen. We do that show every Monday for 8 years.
Is that how the SNL gig came to be as well? Your relationship with Michael Che, or was there a sort of a different avenue?
Yeah, for sure. There's no, it wasn't that show specifically. You know, I'd been friends with him for, I think, like since we started like 3 months apart, basically. I started like 3 months before him. So basically at the same time. So we were in that same class and became fast friends. And then we ran that show together. But again, like, it just comes down to just being there, being, you know, showing up and putting the work in, not just at your own show, but like anytime you're up somewhere, got to show up and do work, you know? And that's what, you know, I did consistently and can try to do consistently now.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So where is kind of your head at, right now? Like after you get, you had an hour come out last year. It was awesome, by the way.
Thank you.
You put that out on YouTube. You self produced it, or no, you didn't. Film 45 produced that one, didn't they?
Film 45 produced, Thank You China. That was a shout out to Brandon. But that was, I mean, I financed it. I financed both of them. Produced it was produced by Film 45. And then this last one, Lucky Lefty, was produced by Pyramid Studios, in terms of, you know, the team and all that, directed by Mookie Thompson. First one was by Marcus Price. But again, like self-financed for sure. This next one, I'm going to take my time with. I think I've, you know, before I came on this podcast, I was just wondering if stand-up was kind of dead, too saturated. I definitely think I'm too saturated. So this next one, I'm going to really take my time with. You know, this, I think I was kind of caught up in the Louis model of do a stand-up, do a special every year, or try to pull one out every year. It's like he's a different person, and he can chop stuff up and like have that deadline for himself. I think this next one I'm going to be really patient with and really put a lot more thought and work in once I hit a spot where I think these are the things I want to talk about.
Yeah. What do you mean you think it's dead?
I think I've definitely participated in the dilution of the art, so to speak. You know, there's just so much stand up out there. And it's this net positive, I think, that everyone who wants to do work can really kind of create their own paths right now, and put their own stuff out there via clips and YouTube and all that kind of stuff. But I do think it does lead to a watering down of the art itself when everyone's coming to a show expecting X, Y, Z, and you give them, you know, ABC kind of thing. Like it is definitely like a mismatch, miscommunication between what stand-up people are expecting and what people want to do. I'm kind of rambling now as I hear myself, but.
No, I hear you. Are you talking about like crowd work? Like you go do a show at a club and people are shouting stuff in order to become part of like a crowd work clip or whatever?
Not even that. I mean, that's part of it, but more so in the sense of like, you can, I put stuff out that is not the best, right? But you kind of put stuff out that's good enough to generate interest and to hit a zeitgeist or whatever it is and have a take that's not going to be relevant or important or talk about something that doesn't, it's not going to matter for, you know, the tenure of, it's not going to stand the test of time. It's not necessarily just like a fully complete bit, you know, but that's just the nature of the business at the moment for a lot of people, myself included, to really ride waves and get myself out there so that people know I exist and will come out to shows. I think it's good in the sense that a lot more people are coming to shows who have never seen stand up before. The art form itself is definitely hit tons of people that would never have gone to a stand-up show, you know, like Matt Rife, for example, you know, a lot of his fans are first time. And this is just me guessing, but I think he would probably concur that a lot of his fans are first time stand-up comedy people. A lot of people that come to my shows, they've never been to a stand-up show before. It's their first one ever. So in that case, it's great. There's a lot more people coming out to stand-up shows. That being said, a lot of stuff on the internet and all that, and stuff of my own included, is not the best. You know, it's a lesser product than if you only had 10 shots to take something, would you be taking these shots? Is that a good look kind of thing? Right now we have an infinite number of shots that you could take. And that just makes things less good.
No, I totally agree with what you're saying, man. Cause I mean, how many times are we just putting up a clip cause we need to feed the algorithm to move tickets to the show, you know? And then exactly. How many of those clips are exactly like what we want to live on for however. And on top of that, how much time, we don't ever really give ourselves like a break really. And right. Because even when you're not on the road, you're putting up content. And so if you're never taking a break, then you're never actually being a real person. And therefore, right. You know, you're actively making time to be a real person, which is like the complete reverse of how life should kind of work, you know. Yeah. But it's like there are things like, I've thought about this before, and then I just think saying it makes me sound kind of like a guy who has too much. But mm-hmm. You know how you have like the unions for SAG and for writing, you know. Mm-hmm. It protects people, gives them vacation, whatever. It you don't really have that when you're doing kind of all the social media stuff. You're just expected to continue to keep creating. I just wonder if there's going to be a some sort of massive burnout of all these creators. Not like it fucking matters for the social media platforms because more will fill that spot. Have you thought about any of that stuff or not much?
I mean, I think there's, I don't know if it will happen en masse, but I'm sure it's happening at a micro level all the time. I'm telling you now, I've experienced it and I'm experiencing it, right? It's just from you become so focused on creating for something other than yourself, that inevitably you hate that that's what you have to do. And it's easy. I don't say it's easy to turn it off, but it can be turned off. That constant kind of feeding the machine, you just got to be okay with the kind of ambiguity of it all. What happens when you do turn it off? Because you're so used to keeping it on. I've been doing stand up social media content for going on 3-4 years now. And so it'll be an interesting adjustment when I go dark on June 3rd or whatever it is entirely. But I've recognized that it is a thing necessary kind of thing to do, which is if you recognize you're being burned out, then don't let that shit burn you out entirely. It's like, okay, it's okay to take a step back. Ultimately, like it's a healthier decision to not let your brain fry.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, do you think about, like, you say you're going dark. Do you think, do you know how long you're going dark for? Or do you?
I might be being dramatic. I'm not sure. I know I'm taking a good amount of time off from hitting the road. If I do anything, it'll be like a pop up here or like a club weekend there just to print some money and shore up my bank accounts. But it won't be because like I really have something to say. It'll be more like, okay, let's see what let me work on stuff. Let me chop stuff up and really utilize the comedy clubs for what they're for and also entertain people and hopefully, you know, maintain a fan base and all that. But it'll be like, it'll be very selective and it'll be a lot more focused in terms of why I'm doing the shows as opposed to I'm doing the shows because that's what the agent set up. I need to be on the road right now. I have this to think about and this to say. But I don't know. You know, it'll be for a while for sure. If and when I do come back within the year, it'll be like, you know, once or twice to do like a comedy club, you know, New Brunswick or Denver Comedy Works or something like that. It won't be this kind of full-blown thing that we got going on.
Yeah. No, I hear you, man. I hear you. With all that said, what can people expect from this tour when they come see you in Milwaukee?
Honestly, this week I'm spending really retooling the set. I watched my friend Jared Freed on last Saturday night, was it the 17th or something? And I was just like blown away by the amount of work that guy's done and the writing he's put in. And maybe it was because I was a little drunk, but I was like, God damn, I gotta get to work. And I look at the set that I've been doing. I'm like, okay, it's got really good jokes, but it's not anywhere near where I need it to be. And it's not living up to what I think it could be. And so like this week, you know, it's getting there. This week I've been on stage quite a bit. And I'll be on stage every night from now until Sunday night, just reworking stuff and putting it together. You can expect to have a very good time. It'll be fun for sure. It's just internally the set itself. I know where I want to get it. And hopefully Milwaukee will be the first stop on this new kind of retooled version of it. And then I have San Jose next weekend on the 29th through whatever. And that's like a club weekend. So that'll be a lot of reps. And then I'm off all of March. I'll be in New York getting up probably once or twice every night for, you know, 6 weeks, which I'm very much looking forward to. And then I'll be back on the road in April.
Nice. And yeah, with your set, when you're talking about just retooling it, you basically mean you like your jokes, but it's not the through line that you want. Is that what you're talking about? Or is it?
It's not the through line that I want. It's not a, there's a lot of meat left on the bone in every joke. You know, I know what I'm good at and what I need to work on is kind of squeezing every drop of blood from a stone kind of thing, you know, like, there's still a lot left. And I could feel it. It just like, even by going on stage last night and, doing an old bit, with a little more patience and like really thinking about what I'm saying a bit more, as opposed to just trying to get to the punchline. Like, oh, okay, oh yeah, there's words there that's funny to add here. There's funny to add here. There's funny to add here. And that's what I mean by kind of retooling, just like trying to get every beat out of every laugh out of a sentence. And that's all Jared Fried's fault. I saw him do that and I was like, God damn, I got it. This next one is the one for him, for sure. It's really strong. And that's one of my close friends. And I've been doing comedy with him for 13, 14 years. And I can see he's hit his next gear, and it kind of invigorates the competitiveness in me that exists within all the narcissists that decide to do comedy.
Yeah.
I gotta get to work. That's what you can expect, a very competitive show on Sunday.
Awesome.
To show up.
Sounds great, man. Well, look, I really appreciate you taking the time, and I hope you find some of those bits writing or on stage. And best of luck, man.
Awesome, man. Thank you, man. We'll see you. Hopefully see you on Sunday.
Yeah, I am coming back from a gig, so I'm hoping to make it I'm coming back from Iowa, so I'm hoping to make it in time.
Awesome, man. We'll hope to see you. If not, thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, dude. Thank you. And we'll hopefully see you soon.
Take care, man.
All right. Peace. We'll see you. Bye-bye. All right, ladies and gents, once again, Nimesh Patel is at Turner Hall Ballroom on Sunday, February 25th. For all you listeners in Milwaukee, go check him out. And you know what? I'll tell you this. If you're just around the country and you want to see him, go to punchup.live/Nimesh Patel, and you can find all his dates. And you can also follow him at Finding Nimesh. And follow us on all platforms at CripesCast. Ladies and gents, it's been fun. Colleen Maraca, thanks for hanging out. Thanks for producing the pod. Hannah Milos, thank you for editing. And everybody, keep her moving and watch for deer. And thank you for listening to the CripesCast. We will see you next week.
So roll out the barrel and get the band brewing. Life's got you down. Just keep her moving. It's on Wisconsin, the Badgers say it's the old Wisconsin. Wisconsin Jubilee.
You know, sometimes when you're ice fishing, you put your foot into walleye hole and go ass over tea kettle and you think you're done. No, you gotta keep her moving.